The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In a time when political leadership across the political spectrum is held in unprecedented low esteem, presidential historian Robert Dalek's latest book reflects on the life of America's greatest political leader of the past century. His book, Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life, recounts the story of the leader who restored confidence in the country's economic system during its deepest depression, convinced and cajoled a country steeped in isolationism to support the fight against fascism, then led that nation successfully through the war, and set up the framework for an international system for peace with the United Nations. The book examines Roosevelt's life and achievements, his missteps, both professional and personal, and reminds us that this revered president today faced spirited opposition and wild rhetoric towards nearly all of his ideas and proposals at the time, even as he won election to the presidency four times. Robert Dalek is a noted presidential historian, author of 12 previous books on presidents and presidential leadership. He's the winner of the Bancroft Prize, American historian's highest award, and the past president of the Society of American Historians. His latest book is titled Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Robert Dalek, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
There have been numerous books on Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In fact, you've written a previous book on one aspect of his leadership. Why were you interested in writing about him today?
Well, because, you know, Rich, there's been so much despair, almost, one might say, about American politics and about politicians. And it seemed to me that it was a good time to remind people of what a great leader, great president looked like, because I think historians are almost universally agreed that he was one of the three great presidents of American history, along with George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. But we've been so discontented, dissatisfied with our recent politicians. The Congress has, what, a 10%, a 12% approval rating?
Right.
The current incumbent seems to be in the 30s on his approval rating. And it's well to recall that our system of government can generate a great leader. And I think Franklin Roosevelt very much fills that bill, because he had to struggle with two monumental challenges during his 12-plus year presidency. First off, of course, the Great Depression, in which something like 25% of the workforce was unemployed, and people were facing and frightened by the possibility of starvation, and they struggled mightily with the economy. Young women in New England would work in the textile industry. If they were lucky enough to get work, they were paid 7.5 cents an hour. If they could get a 10-hour day, they made 75 cents, which in those days was worth something. And it was a great struggle for the preservation of the national system of government and free enterprise. And then, of course, Roosevelt had to face the challenge of isolationism, which the cynicism that had evolved from World War One, and the sense of pacifism and determination to resist involvement in any other European conflict. And then, of course, when we did get into the war after Pearl Harbor, leading the country to victory over fascism and Nazism and Japanese militarism. And so it was two monumental challenges that Roosevelt overcame. And, of course, into the bargain, winning four presidential terms. And, of course, he was, his health was in a sharp decline in the last 4 or 5 years of his presidency. He had, it seems, congestive heart failure and had a terrible, what's called angina, and would writhe in pain and sweat over the heart disease he was struggling with. He had terrible hypertension. Winston Churchill's physician, Lord Moran, saw him at the Yalta Conference in February 1945, and he wrote in his diary, "The president is suffering from hardening of the arteries of the brain. He'll be dead in 3 months' time. And he called it right on the shot because Roosevelt, of course, died on April 12, 1945.
Now, one of your revelations in the book is that he was perhaps more sick than we realized a lot earlier than even a lot of historians have thought. I mean, at what point would you say that perhaps he shouldn't have been thinking about being the president?
Well, I think,
health-wise.
Yeah, well, by 1944, he himself had doubts, but public opinion polls showed that if the war was still on, they wanted him to be elected to a fourth term. If the war were over, he never would have won another term, and I don't think he would have run again, you see. And in fact, he talked about the possibility that he would spend 1 year in a fourth term, and then he would resign, and he wanted to be the head of some kind of international peace organization, you see. But of course, he died just a few months into his fourth term, and he was quite ill by then. He would have some blackouts, and now people have argued about whether Stalin took advantage of him at Yalta because of his Roosevelt's increasing sickness or illness or disability, and I don't think so, in the sense that much of what Roosevelt did at Yalta was in line with pretty much what he had been doing all along. And besides, by February 1945, it was clear that the Soviet Union was tearing the guts out of the Nazi war machine, and that it was going to dominate Eastern Europe, and that they had the military might to do it, and that the United States wasn't, as Roosevelt himself said, when people complained to him about not doing more for Poland, and he said, well, what do you want me to do, go to war with Russia? You see, that it was inconceivable to embark on that. And so those were the realities that shaped the post-war world.
Now, it's a very difficult task for a writer to tell Franklin Roosevelt's story in one volume. It's a big book, I should mention, but you spend about half the book on his presidencies and half leading up to the presidency. And, of course, many writers have taken multiple volumes to write about him. But if you can look at the overall arc of his life, what was his central ability at providing leadership? What do you think the central critical skill was?
I think the central critical skill was what Winston Churchill captured in a phrase when he said, meeting Roosevelt for the first time was like uncorking a bottle of champagne. The temperament, the man had an extraordinarily buoyant, upbeat, positive outlook on the world, and this despite the fact that he had been so terribly immobilized by his polio, and that he spent his waking hours in a wheelchair. And at one point I found a letter which he wrote to somebody in which he said, when you're frustrated, you get up and walk around and let off some of the steam. He said, I'm stuck here in this chair and I can't move. But, you know, he put the best face on everything. He would hold press conferences and the reporters would gather around him in the Oval Office. And at the end of the conference, Roosevelt would say, well, boys, I've got to run now. Well, of course, he couldn't run. You know, he couldn't even barely walk. But it was a way of presenting himself as dynamic, as free to move about and lead. And so there was a quality of leadership and hope that he instilled in the nation and gave people a sense of promise that the future was once again rosy. You know, when he began running, the theme song they used was Anchors Away, which tied into his service as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. But they changed it to Happy Days Are Here Again. And it was a very shrewd shift of theme,
right,
because that's what they wanted to make the country believe.
Now, you mentioned Churchill mentioning he was like opening a bottle of champagne. Their actual first meeting, Roosevelt did not strike Churchill in that way. In fact, he practically didn't even notice him. It was back when they were both Navy men for their various government. And I think the consensus about Roosevelt was he was a patrician, happy-go-lucky, glib politician. Many historians look at his contracting polio as a maturing element. It gave him an insight into ordinary people's lives. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with it. I think it created a sense of empathy on his part, of compassion for the struggles that people go through in life. He had been born to the purple, as they say, or had a golden career and was well off and very comfortable and went to Groton and to Harvard. And he took a terrible hit with that polio. You know, when they first, I don't know if you've ever visited the Roosevelt Memorial here in Washington, D.C., but now if you visit it, you see Roosevelt, the first thing you see is Roosevelt in a wheelchair. But that wasn't there when the memorial first opened. But there was pressure from the disability community to be honest about what Roosevelt's condition was, so they added that statue. Now, Roosevelt himself did as much as he could to hide his disability during his presidency. There are surviving photographs of his incapacity. And in fact, it served Roosevelt psychologically, or served the country psychologically, because people knew that he had been afflicted with this paralytic disease, but they thought he had recovered from it. And it was sort of a metaphor for what the country could do in the Depression. Here was a man who had recovered from this disability in his personal life, and therefore he was perfectly suited to lead the country toward a recovery in the Depression. And of course, Depression didn't end as a consequence of the New Deal. That was industrial mobilization that did that. But he did something more important. He humanized the American industrial system. He put into place all sorts of programs like FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, that guaranteed people's bank accounts so that they wouldn't lose their life savings as they were doing in the Depression. The TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, that turned a impoverished region of the South into a much more prosperous place. The Securities and Exchange Commission that policed the stock markets, and the WPA and the PWA and the roads and the airports, the libraries, the dams that they built, and the conservation that they promoted made a huge difference. And then, of course, Social Security and the wages and hours law, minimum wage and maximum hours, housing legislation, support to help farmers and homeowners from keep them from losing their property. And it was a very humanizing program, a welfare state that made a huge difference in people's lives.
I was struck by something you said about the New Deal. You know, you rightly mentioned that it was industrial mobilization that really ended the Depression. But the central tenet of the New Deal was, and this was new for federal government, let's try something and see if it works. And he very much had that attitude. And of all those things you mentioned, some worked really well, some did not work so well.
That's right.
And
he made his errors, you know, that court packing plan pretty much fell on its face. The attempt to purge the Democratic Party of its conservative, particularly conservative Southern members of Congress, that failed. So, you know, he wasn't perfect. He wasn't a saint. His failure to deal more robustly with the Holocaust has cost him retrospective criticism. But, you know, there were more hits than there were misses.
You mentioned the purge of Southern conservative Democrats. that was something he was very, I mean, he did try, but he, once he saw that it wasn't going to work, he really did not do a whole lot on civil rights. I mean, he did a little bit, but not nearly where everybody else wanted him to be. He never came out in favor of an anti-lynching law. He tended to back industries more than unions, as far as, especially in regard to like the Portman's Union and things like that.
Yes.
He was very aware that his majorities were made up of Northern Democrats and Southern Democrats.
Yep, quite right. And also, he was very much influenced by the fact that so many of the committee chairmanships in the House and the Senate were in the hands of segregationist Southerners. And he would not take them on over segregation or civil rights. But the irony, of course, is that by the end of Roosevelt's presidency, African Americans, who had been largely Republican voters, had shifted to the Democratic Party. And the saying had become, turn Lincoln's face to the wall. And the New Deal, despite the fact that it wasn't primarily focused on helping African Americans or minorities, gave them enough to make them loyal to the New Deal, and ever since to the Democratic Party. So that was a transforming moment in our history.
My guest today is presidential historian Robert Dalek. His new book is titled Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. It's published by Viking. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, as we're going around another tenet of Roosevelt that was very frustrating to those around him, I think Huey Long said, Roosevelt, you go in and you say, this is what needs to be done. And he goes, yes, yes, yes. And then the guy that believes in 180 degrees opposite of what I believe goes in and says, this is what should be done. And he goes, yes, yes, yes. And his ability to give everyone the impression he agreed with him.
That's right.
Is that a good presidential leadership technique, or was it just sort of the way Roosevelt worked?
If this were in the day when there was multimedia and an internet, and people jumped on this and said, what a phony, you know, he says yes to this one, yes to that one. But of course, in Roosevelt's day, there were newspapers and radio, and these were sort of internal conversations, and it was the way Roosevelt dealt with difficult, abrasive people like a Huey Long. And Huey Long, in 1935, said, Frank knows I could beat him, you see. And Long was planning to run against him in 36 because, remember, Long had something called Share the Wealth, and he was a very smart, brilliant demagogue.
Populist,
and Roosevelt said, the two most dangerous men in America are Huey Long and General Douglas MacArthur. Now, Long, of course, was assassinated in the fall of 1935, so that threat of him running against Roosevelt, I don't think he would have beat Roosevelt anyway, but still, he was a formidable challenger.
Now, you mentioned Douglas MacArthur. Was that due to the fact that he was so willingly put down the Bonus Army? You described this incident the year before Roosevelt's election, where the World War I veterans marched on Washington. They were in the midst of the Depression, really hurting. They're asking for their bonus, which were promised by Congress. Hoover calls out the Army, and Douglas MacArthur, you have this image of him standing astride a military vehicle, basically pushing his comrades out of Washington. Was that why he was afraid of Douglas MacArthur?
Well, I think he knew MacArthur. Mm-hmm. And there's the story that very early in his presidency, MacArthur came in to see him, to lobby him to increase the income or money that would be given to the military, and in particular to the United States Army, because it had become a shadow army. The United States Army at that point had fewer men in it than Sweden or Switzerland. It was a ghost army almost. And MacArthur said to Roosevelt, because Roosevelt was trying to cut back on expenses. This is 1933. He'd want to run huge deficits. And MacArthur said to him, when a Japanese boy sticks a bayonet into an American in the Philippines, I hope the last words that the American soldier spits out are Roosevelt. And Roosevelt turned beet red, and he said to MacArthur, Douglas, you must not talk that way to the commander-in-chief, but we must get together on this army business. Roosevelt knew that MacArthur was a formidable figure and that he was ambitious, and like Long was. And Roosevelt could read these guys, and but he would also stroke them. But behind their backs, he was going to sing a very different song.
Yeah. I want to ask you, you write about the New Deal acts, and we forget, we think of all of the New Deal, you know, Social Security, rural electrification, for example, as being,
yep,
everybody was for it. There was intense opposition to a lot of these measures from certain quarters, especially those with money. And
yep,
it reminds me that, you know, we've come through our own mini depression. 2008, if we had done the same thing they'd done in 1929, we might have been looking at the same sort of depression. I mean, that's the one thing we have to remember about the Great Depression. They didn't do anything very much about it for about 3 years and made it much worse.
Right.
But there was large resistance to the stimulus, the bailouts of the banks, certainly, and of the automotive industry. And a certain, you know, you look at even the ACA. Was that comparable to the resistance to a lot of things that were happening in the New Deal? This sort of...
I mean, you know, it never ends. There is this attitude in the country of skepticism and antagonism to the federal government. And I live in Washington, D.C., but I go for a month each year in February to San Diego. And, of course, a lot of that material well-being in San Diego revolves around the military, which, of course, has... a Marine base nearby and a naval station, and but people are antagonistic to the federal government. It doesn't make a great deal of sense, but there is this sort of mindset that the feds are going to interfere, they're going to destroy individual rights, they're going to overreach themselves and undermine civil liberties, and but when the country gets into crisis, when, of course, it suffers one of these terrible hurricanes, or it turns to the federal government for support, for help, and it's a very old story, very familiar one.
My guest today is Robert Dalek, a presidential historian. His new book is titled Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. It's published by Viking. Well, regardless of how you feel about our current president, one of the things you have to say, he has mastered a new technology.
That's right.
Twitter.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Franklin Roosevelt also mastered it, what was then a new technology for a president, and that
that's
was
right.
Radio. In fact, he was
that's
doing that well before he became president. He was doing fireside chats as governor of New York. How
that's
important
right.
was this to
hugely.
Explain?
It was hugely important. Just the way you see, I agree with you. John Kennedy mastered television. He was the first one to do live televised press conferences, you see. And now Donald Trump has succeeded using this new internet technology, this social media, and this tweeting. So it's really quite shrewd on the part of a political leader to pioneer the use of one of these new ways of communicating with a mass audience. And Roosevelt was brilliant at it, and you're quite right. He did it as governor of New York and then developed it. And, of course, people think that these fireside chats he gave on the radio, that like he was giving one a week or one a month. In fact, there were only 31 in his 12 years of the presidency, 12 plus years of the presidency. And so he was very cautious about not overexposing himself, so to speak. And but he used it brilliantly, and he understood that he could create a sense of connection. And indeed, you know, after he died, somebody stopped Mrs. Roosevelt on the street and said to her, "I miss the way your husband used to speak to me about my government." And there's the anecdote about the man who stood sobbing by the railway railroad track as Roosevelt's funeral train went by, and somebody said to him, "Did you know the president?" And the man said, "No, but he knew me." See, can you imagine anyone saying that about any politician now?
And the radio allowed him to bypass a lot of the opposition, because your book really outlines there were powerful interests against nearly every New Deal idea, and isolationism against getting involved in what would be World War II. And he used radio as a way to bypass that, much as President Trump is using Twitter to bypass traditional media to talk to, you know, talk to straight to his constituents.
Of course, one of the big differences is that Trump seems to have a following of about 36% to 40%.
Yeah.
Franklin Roosevelt had a majority of the country. I don't think his public approval rating ever went below 50%, at least on these, you know, general approval measures, which is really pretty impressive.
Well, last question. One of the things you said is that he never got ahead of the country. Was that probably one of his biggest abilities as far as able to mobilize public opinion?
I think so. You see, I think that his style of leadership was to be a half step ahead of public opinion. He could feel where the public was at. Not in every instance. He misread the country's mood when he failed to put across that court-packing plan. He misread the public's mood when he tried to purge the party in 1938 of its conservative Democrats, particularly Southerners, you see. So it was not perfect, but by and large, he was very good at sensing, without even the polls, but sensing where the public was at and being able to articulate the feelings, the attitudes of that current moment.
Robert Dalek, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Robert Dalek is the author of Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.